You're listening to Back in the USSR.
Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции. Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы. Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества. Ура!
Flames danced all around. No hope for black when the rise up east, but the devil on the run. Freedom's day has come. Silhouettes in a Belfast night, dark figures stalk the streets, bringing pain or plastic bullets out. Every kid that he meets, strangers' laws and strangers' ways can never hold us down. Risen hearts with freedom's cry, resistance is all around. Death now for the crown.
You're listening to Back in the USSR on 93.3 FM CFRU in Guelph. I am Siegfried. That song that you just heard is called Monsters, Devils, and Strangers. It was recorded by Irish Republican prisoners of war in a British jail outside Belfast on March 1st, 1991. That day was the 10th anniversary of the hunger strike that began on March 1st, 1981. In which 10 members of the Irish Resistance, Bobby Sands, Francis Hughes, Ray McCreesh, Patsy O'Hara, Joe McDonnell, Martin Herson, Kevin Lynch, Kieran Doherty, Tom McElwee, and Michael Devine gave their lives for the cause of Irish liberation from British colonialism. That song you just heard is all about that struggle for liberation. Not just in Ireland, but all over the world. It really is a song of international solidarity, including solidarity with the anti-apartheid struggle in South Africa that was going on in 1991. And of course, you know, that struggle against colonialism includes the struggle against colonialism going on in this very colonial society that is Canada. Comrades and friends, we've come to the end of February. But the epic struggle that gripped this country over the course of the past month has only just begun. It really has. It's only just begun. It began with the RCMP and Coastal GasLink's invasion of sovereign Indigenous Wet'suwet'en territory in the province that goes by the colonial name of British Columbia, backed by snipers and armored vehicles. It began with the arrest of Indigenous land defenders, matriarchs, and hereditary chiefs. It began with the mass arrests of Indigenous land defenders and their allies who blockaded the Port of Vancouver and closed down rail lines across the country in a show of solidarity with the Wet'suwet'en people and in staunch opposition to the settler colonial state that is invading their lands and oppressing them in the name of extractive industry and fossil fuel expansion through pipelines built on stolen Indigenous land. And the movement continues to grow. Bridges, ports, railways, the offices of prominent politicians and corporations all have been occupied and shut down. And Guelph is no exception. There have been some impressive actions here in this city as well. And there's also been a strong international component, international solidarity. including from Palestinians, who were also facing genocide at the hands of a brutal settler colonial regime, just like indigenous people in this country are. And I want people to appreciate, the people who are listening to this, I want people to appreciate just how radical all this is. How radical this development is. The Mohawk scholar, Gerald Taiaki Alfred, was a former professor of political science and indigenous governance at the University of Victoria. In responding to the unprecedented solidarity that indigenous land defenders are receiving from wider Canadian society, he said that Canada is experiencing a genuine revolutionary moment. And I want to quote him. I can remember saying 15, 20 years ago that if we ever had a development in our movement where the power of indigenous nationhood and indigenous rights could be melded and brought together with the power of young Canadians who are committed to the environment and social justice, it would be revolutionary. And I think that's what we're witnessing. And according to Alfred, the protests are providing, quote, a channel among Indigenous youth, Canadian youth, non-Indigenous allies, who are just so angry and frustrated at the hypocrisy and the foot-dragging and the corruption that they see in their own government. I think that this movement here is reflective of their commitment to take action, to confront what they see in all aspects of their life, not only in politics, but within the culture, within the relationships that they have, a culture among people who have power that allows them to act with impunity and hypocrisy. When the RCMP invaded Wet'suwet'en territory, when the RCMP invaded Wet'suwet'en territory, it's the confluence of all these things on an intellectual level, political level, on a visual sense, because of social media, and also on the emotional level. It's driven by the consequence, I would say, of an intellectual understanding of the injustice in the society, of a political commitment to do something about it, and the emotional energy recognizing that they are witnessing and living through the actual suppression and acts of violence against primarily Indigenous women who are defending that territory, as they always have done. Alfred said that it has become clear to everyone that what's happening in the woods and territories is a microcosm of all of that. And it's provoking a response on all levels of those, on all of those levels, intellectually, politically, and emotionally. And I think that's why you see such passion. Such passionate resistance. And that was Mohawk scholar Gerald Taiaki Alfred. And I say, this is a radical time, brothers and sisters. This is a radical time. What we're seeing is a developing mass movement against the capitalist colonial state in Canada. The solidarity movement that's emerged in solidarity with the Wet'suwet'en people after their land was invaded by the RCMP and by Coastal GasLink pipeline. We see the emergence of this mass movement against the capitalist colonial state in Canada. A state whose real economic priorities now stand revealed for what they are, exposing Justin Trudeau's many, many, many lies about reconciliation and a nation-to-nation relationship with Indigenous peoples, in addition to his two-faced positions on climate change and the environment. And people are truly catching wise to the role of capitalism in all this, and how capitalism is the driving force, the real driving force behind colonial policies that oppress Indigenous people and destroy the environment. It's really the driving force behind that. The profit motive is the driving force behind that, and the interests of these big corporations and the Fortune 500 and all that, and the global interests that they have. To recap on the basic information, behind this, the emergence of this movement. The Wet'suwet'en Nation is resisting the construction of the $6.6 billion Coastal GasLink pipeline through their land their sovereign land, on ceded land. At 670 kilometers, the pipeline will cut a massive swath through indigenous lands in northern BC, with the goal of transporting fracked natural gas from the northeast part of BC, to a coastal terminal near the town of Kitimat, where it would be processed for overseas exports. The pipeline itself is only one part of a $40 billion fossil fuel infrastructure project by LNG Canada that has been described as a carbon bomb by Mark Lee, a senior economist with the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives. You know, a carbon bomb that would result in an increase of carbon emissions equal to all the cars on the road in BC combined. You know, that's how much more carbon would be emitted, and that's a massive amount. The Canadian federal government and the NDP premier of BC, John Horgan, have thrown their weight behind the pipeline. But the real answer as to why so much money and resources are being put into this destructive and invasive project, and why court injunctions against its opponents are being enforced so rigorously and violently by the RCMP, are to be found in the current state of Canadian capitalism. Canada has some of the largest oil and gas reserves in the world, and the investments in this industry are greater than any other sector in the Canadian economy. The export of oil and gas to external markets, particularly the United States, has traditionally been a crucial pillar in the Canadian state's efforts to offset problems of profitability in the broader economy, where stagnating wages, the gradual elimination of well-paid manufacturing jobs, runaway debt, and a massive real estate bubble are threatening to plunge the system into crisis. And the Canadian government has always seen like resource exports, you know, particularly oil and gas, as a way to offset that crisis in profitability in the capitalist system. You know, with declining profit margins and all that. However, the United States is, as a result of the massive growth in the fracking industry, you know, the reason why you can, in many cases, light your tap water on fire in many parts of the United States now. The United States, because of fracking, no longer imports nearly as much oil as it once did, and is in fact set to become a major oil exporter over the course of the next decade. And obviously this is something Trump's really been pushing hard, you know, going crazy, deregulating, you know, cutting back on every single environmental protection in the book, basically, you know, to encourage this industry, this fracking industry, so that America can be, quote, energy independent. This has been a big thing that he's been all about. And of course, this has led to a decline in profitability for Canadian oil producers, you know, because basically the United States doesn't need them anymore. And so since 2006 in particular, you know, where fracking in the States really began to take off around 2006, Canadian oil producers have been trying to offset this decline in exports to the U.S. by finding overseas markets for their oil, particularly in Asia. You know, they really want to export their oil to Asia. Both the Harper and Trudeau governments have therefore invested considerable resources in facilitating profitable fossil fuel exports to potential Asian markets. You know, there's been a continuity of policy on this, you know, between the Harper government and the Trudeau government, you know, which Trudeau tried to downplay and tried to conceal, but which nonetheless was there, and now it's blatantly revealed just how much continuity there was. And this explains why Trudeau has been so politically and financially dedicated to pipeline expansion through British Columbia to the West Coast, even when it overrides, you know, completely destroys any credibility of his statements on the existential threat of climate change, on the need to cut carbon emissions, and on the rights of Indigenous peoples. You know, all of that is secondary at best to the needs of the Canadian capitalist class, you know, the businessmen and bankers who want to export their oil overseas, and on whose behalf the state issues injunctions and sends in heavily armed police to evict Indigenous land defenders from their own sovereign unceded territories. So none of this is accidental. None of it is the result of some innocent misunderstanding Justin Trudeau has given the fossil fuel industry more than $3 billion in tax subsidies while spending $4.5 billion to buy the Trans Mountain Pipeline from Kinder Morgan to ensure that it gets built, and while using paramilitary violence to displace Indigenous peoples who are in the way, quote unquote. I mean, the sheer police presence outside of the world's largest mining convention, which began at the Toronto Metro Convention Center on March 1st, likewise speaks volumes, given that more than 60% of the world's mining corporations are headquartered in Canada. I think like something like 100 demonstrators were outside that convention center, but like, you know, there were, you know, they were seriously outnumbered by the cops, who showed up just in major force. You know, just a wall of cops, you know, like trying to, you know, prevent, you know, these 100 demonstrators from even being seen by the delegates who were showing up and going in. You know, just a massive show of force. You know, it shows you the kind of power that that extractive industry has in the Canadian economy. You know, and the influence it has over the Canadian state. As Todd Gordon and Jeffrey McCormack point out, quote, the Canadian state has evolved to optimize the conditions for capital accumulation. This commitment to Canadian capitalism is at its core a colonialist project, predicated upon and reproducing it, and is utterly irreconcilable with ecological sustainability. Once again, this is not accidental. We should not be surprised when the Ontario Provincial Police, the OPP, move in and violently arrest Mohawk land defenders blocking the rails at Tiendanaga, you know, near Belleville. You know, and that blockade was in support of Wet'suwet'en, or when the OPP conduct mass arrests of people standing in solidarity with similar blockades, or Canadian police in general, RCMP, you know, conduct mass arrests of people standing in solidarity with similar blockades in Vancouver, Hamilton, or the GTA. You know, 37 people were arrested around the Lambton area last week. Nor should we be surprised when the Canadian far right, including the Soldiers of Odin and these fascist groups, would call in bomb threats against the Tiendanaga land defenders and threaten to attack the demonstrators occupying the provincial government buildings in Victoria, BC, you know, in solidarity with the Wet'suwet'en. You know, the Wet'suwet'en people themselves have faced similar threats from settler vigilantes and other people brainwashed by the ideology of white supremacy, which has functioned as a useful tool of capitalist exploitation and resource extraction in colonial North America from the late 17th century. I mean, Conservative Party leader Andrew Scheer's demand that lethal force be used to clear the blockades and the demonization of the land defenders in the Canadian corporate press reveals just how entrenched racist settler colonialism is in this country. But nonetheless, things are changing. Things are shifting. You know, it says something in a settler colonial society when, you know, polling data reveals that 39% of the non-Indigenous population support the blockades and support Wet'suwet'en. You know, in a society built on genocide, built on racism, built on, you know, colonial dispossession of Indigenous people, seizing their land, exploiting it, and all that, you know, a society that's founded on that, to see this level of support from non-Indigenous people, you know, that level of support, that level of solidarity going towards the Wet'suwet'en people and now other Indigenous groups of people who are standing in solidarity with the Wet'suwet'en, setting up blockades, you know, trying to shut this country down, trying to force the Canadian government to come to the negotiating table, you know, to stop this invasion of sovereign Indigenous lands in BC, you know, to actually negotiate in good faith. and to come to some sort of settlement. But, you know, it's incredible, the kind of support. The Wet'suwet'en is getting. And I want to quote Tekaya Blaney, who's one of the young indigenous land defenders occupying the steps of the BC legislature in what they, and this is what they said on February 29th when the soldiers of Odin threatened them with violence. You know, they threatened to show up in a whole counter demonstration and threatened to attack them and whatnot. And Tekaya Blaney said, quote, "White supremacists feel threatened because they know their systems are dying. And we indigenous people are very much alive." You know, white supremacists feel threatened because they know their systems are dying, and we indigenous people are very much alive. The very survival of indigenous nations in the face of colonial genocide is itself a revolutionary act. And now it's clear just how empty the phrase reconciliation is. I mean, how can a victim of genocide reconcile themselves to a genocidal system? You know, how is that possible? I mean, would you ask a Jew to reconcile with the government of Nazi Germany in the wake of the Holocaust? Settler colonialism cannot be reconciled with. And in fact, to even ask a indigenous person to reconcile with a system, with a government that is, you know, engaged in genocide against their people is just, you know, ludicrous. You know, downright offensive. In fact, that request would even be made, you know, let alone complied with. You know, settler colonialism, genocide, you know, cannot be reconciled with. And to think that it can is almost like just lunacy. So, like, you know, of course there's been a lot of talk that reconciliation basically is dead. But it was never really alive to begin with in this country. I mean, settler colonialism, like all forms of colonialism, has to be broken down and ultimately overthrown entirely, along with the capitalist system that drives it and makes it possible. And there must be revolutionary change. What that revolutionary change is going to look like, I mean, you know, we're not sure. But of course, basically, the system as it now stands has to be torn down. And indigenous people and non-indigenous people are going to have to work out what comes afterwards. And the fact that, once again, to restate this, the fact that so many non-indigenous people in this country understand that settler colonialism cannot stand and that it has to be overthrown along with the capitalist system that drives it and makes it possible. The fact that so many non-indigenous people in this country understand this now and are acting on that understanding is truly revolutionary. And I have to tell you, I have confidence that their internationalist solidarity, their growing internationalist solidarity, because remember, people like the Wet'suwet'en, basically they're not Canadians, you know, they have their own nations. And standing in solidarity with them is respecting their self-determination as a nation. And really people grasp that. So, I mean, I have confidence that the internationalist solidarity of the settler activists who were standing in solidarity with Indigenous land defenders is going to build, it's going to carry forward, and it will ultimately sound the death knell for colonial rule in this land. And it's going to have to. It's going to have to, because given what's going on in the world today, we don't have forever, you know. We don't have forever to get these things sorted out. We have to act now. We have to take care of things right now. And we have to make it happen. We have to build a new society right now. And people understand that. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
I pity the country, I pity the state, and the mind of a man thrives on hate. Small are the lies of cheats and of liars, of bigoted news press, fascist town crier. Deception annoys me, deception destroys me. The Bill of Rights throws me in jails, they all know me. Frustrated are churchmen, saving a soul, man. The tinker, the tailor, the colonial governor, they pull and they palm me. They're seeking to draw me away from the roundness of the life. Servants, they thrive off my body. Their trip is with power, back bacon and welfare. Police, they arrest me. Materialists test me. Pollution, it chokes me. Movies, they joke me. Politicians exploit me. City life jades me. Hudson, they fleece me. Hunting laws throw me. Government is bumbling. Revolution's rumbling. To be ruled in impunity is tradition continuity. I pity the country. I pity the state. And the mind of a man who thrives on hate.
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That was Willie Dunn, Aboriginal Canadian artist, from the film The Other Side of the Ledger, about the abuses that the Hudson's Bay Company committed against Indigenous Canadians, which is from the National Film Board back in the 1970s. Now, here on Back in the USSR, of course, we're against colonialism. We're against settler colonialism, against imperialism, and we also stand against capitalism and understand how these things are intertwined in Canada. And this is, of course, June 30th, the day before Canada Day. Some people might not appreciate the things which I will have to say tonight. They will find it offensive. You know, they want to believe that their country is a good country, that it can do no wrong. And they want to feel secure in that. But ultimately, the truth must be told, for this is a settler colonial society. And the systemic injustice, that this society perpetuates, which Willie Dunn sings about, that has to be exposed for what it is. That needs to be talked about, that needs to be engaged, and it needs to be defeated, it needs to be overthrown. That's ultimately what needs to happen. And, you know, it's important to understand how these things are connected. There was an event today I went to. There was a demonstration in downtown Guelph that was very well attended, I'm very happy to say. I haven't seen that kind of numbers of people showing up in front of City Hall since I went to the memorial for Colton Bushi earlier this year. And what this was about was to protest against the barbaric detention of migrant children by American authorities. But as a number of like indigenous activists who were there pointed out, this also happens in Canada. This is a crime of Canadian colonialism as well as American colonialism. This is a crime that happens in Canada. Detention of children happens in Canada. I talked a little bit about that last week. And I just want to mention again that, you know, concentration camps for kids are not unique to the United States. You know, when this whole story about the separation of migrant children from their parents really blew up in the U.S. recently, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau gave his usual lukewarm, annoying criticism of the Donald Trump administration and said something, in fact, this is not the way we do things in Canada. He was lying. Not for the first time. He was lying, flat out. In recent years, Canada has detained hundreds of migrant children from the Middle East, West Africa, Central America, and the Caribbean. I mentioned this last week. I'll mention it again. In February 2017, the report, Invisible Citizens, Canadian Children in Immigration Detention, came out. It was a study produced by the International Human Rights Program at the University of Toronto's Faculty of Law. And it revealed that there were 48 kids being detained in the Toronto Immigration Holding Center alone at that time in 2017 when that report came out, including infants and toddlers, right? So we're not even talking like older kids here. We're talking like young kids, you know, babies even. And they're in detention in Canada. And that's still going on here. Like once again, this here today in 2018, once again, that study only covered the detention center in Toronto. It didn't look at Lindsay. It didn't look at the many other detention facilities that exist across this country. So that isn't even a complete picture of what's going on. But it's going on here. And I'm glad that that was at least mentioned today. I mean, a lot of people didn't really... It seemed that a lot of people at that who went to that rally like did not realize that. They didn't understand that. And they thought this was just an American phenomenon. Like Canada has nothing to do with it. Well, Canada, of course, also has believes, you know, continues to classify the United States as a safe country for refugees. They will not accept people who come from the United States to Canada seeking asylum because the United States is considered a safe country, even though, you know, we know the kind of crimes they commit against migrants, the kind of atrocities they commit. You know, it's clear for all to see now, but they're still considered a safe country. So that needs to be pointed out. That needs to be understood. Another thing I also want to mention, because I've been covering this for the last several months, you know, and it's a very difficult thing to talk about, but Friday, June 29th, 2018, Israeli regime forces once again opened fire upon peaceful demonstrators in Gaza, killing two and injuring more than 420. The two killed were 13-year-old Yasser Abu Naja and Muhammad Al Hamadia, who was 25 years old. And the 13-year-old child was executed by an Israeli sniper who targeted him with an explosive bullet. So not, once again, not indiscriminate violence, very targeted, very deliberate murder. And the head wound inflicted upon the child killed him instantly. And reporters from the Gaza's health ministry indicate that journalists and medics were among those injured. More than 420, of course, were injured. You know, including a man who was shot in the neck and remains in critical condition. So this is what's going on. This is, once again, the face of colonialism, imperialism in Palestine. And we understand what the face of colonialism is in North America as well and how brutal that is. So the connection needs to be made. Once again, all these states support each other. I mean, God knows Israel is considered a safe country as well. So all this stuff needs to be taken to task. You know, all this stuff needs to be dealt with. You cannot simply ignore this. You cannot simply go out on Canada Day, paint your face, go to like go to parties, go to fireworks displays, all this sort of stuff, and not recognize this kind of thing. This is the land we stand on. And it's stolen Indigenous land. Man, that's what we're going to talk about today. I have in the studio Brennan Campisi here again.
Hello.
I had him on earlier this month, I believe, when we talked before about the struggles of Indigenous people in this country for liberation against a settler colonial state, which was frankly crushing them and still is. And so I decided to bring him back on just, you know, here before Canada Day, like in a very timely show, talk about these things, talk about all the things that need to be addressed. Frankly, if you're going to be truthful about where this country actually stands right now. So thank you very much for coming on.
Always good to be here.
Mm-hmm. So I understand you wanted to start by saying a few words about a particular philosopher who deserves more credit than he usually gets, and more of a profile than he usually gets, a late philosopher.
Yes.
Right. So if you want to maybe start with that.
Sure. Yeah. So the first thing just that I wanted to say this week was just to make note that we lost an exemplary revolutionary intellectual this week when Domenico Lucerto, the Italian communist philosopher and historian, died at the age of 77. And Lucerto had written a series of extremely important and relatively influential works, including, but not limited to, Liberalism, a Counter-History, which is sort of an exposure of the oppression, violence, and racism that are tied up in the entire Western liberal tradition, War and Revolution, which is a critique of sort of the narrative of totalitarianism and the equation of communism and fascism, and sort of trying to connect fascism with its true historical roots in European colonialism. He wrote a critique of the sort of the black legend around Joseph Stalin, and he wrote I think his last sort of major work was sort of an exploration of the concept of the class struggle in Marx and Engels and Lenin, and sort of trying to apply it to the world today. And he also wrote many sort of essays on, you know, topics ranging from contemporary China to sort of the how we should evaluate sort of the general kind of fate of the communist movement in the 20th century. And Lucerto, through all of this work, made a number of important contributions. There was a number of sort of consistent emphases in his work. One was to defend the historical record of the communist movement and to point out that, you know, all of its, you know, errors and shortcomings in the 20th century have to be understood in the context of, you know, the struggle against a global system of imperialism. And he also sort of placed the struggle of the colonized majority of humanity for liberation at the center of political struggle in the 20th century, and in his sort of later political interventions around contemporary conditions, he had that same focus. He always he made a point of talking about Syria, the need to support the struggle of the Syrian people for independence and sovereignty, for example, and he always made a point of taking care to expose the sort of the self-flattering sort of mythology that liberal Western societies sort of create about themselves. And I think it's especially that last note that actually does tie into what we're going to talk about today, because God knows Canada is no stranger, Canadian society is no stranger to self-flattering mythology. And so there's definitely a lot of work to be done in terms of trying to counter that and trying to deal with that. But yeah, I just wanted to say a few words about a really, really great, great communist that we lost this week.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a very, very significant. I wish more people knew about him, honestly.
And absolutely. Then,
now, we did talk, of course, about colonial violence. And, of course, this is something Lizardo focused on quite a lot, like colonial violence and genocide.
Yeah.
These two concepts. And we talked about that to some degree last time. Mm-hmm. You were on the show. But we didn't talk about, like, say, the reserve system or the Indian Act or the destruction of indigenous economies, really. Maybe we talked a little bit about that. But there was a lot of things that, and the residential school system and these matters, really, we didn't get a chance to really focus on last time. So I think maybe we can start talk by focusing on that.
Sure, yeah. So I think this sort of carries on chronologically from what we talked about the last time that I was on, which was mostly focused on the 18th, or at least as far as colonialism, on the 18th and 19th centuries. And we sort of left off with, you know, the late 19th century defeat of the Mitzi resistance, which sort of paved the way for the establishment, at least in the West, of the reserve system as we've come to know it. And I sort of want to focus particularly on the economic aspects of the reserve system, because I think there's something that happens a lot in especially sort of more mainstream and more liberal discussions of just the, you know, the oppression of indigenous people in Canada, which is that there's a sort of a focus on the category of culture in a way that's understood as being sort of abstracted from, you know, people's sort of day-to-day efforts to keep themselves alive. And there's this idea that, sort of the cultural aspect of this is at the center. And we'll sort of break down that distinction in a little bit, because it really is an artificial distinction. So first off, certain sort of aspects of the economic effects of the reserve system. And I think this is really, really important to understand because, you know, one of the defining facts of Indigenous life in contemporary Canada is poverty. And, you know, Canadian society, mainstream Canadian society, has a number of different ways of explaining Indigenous poverty. And some of them are sort of, you know, there's, you know, sympathetic but sort of patronizing narratives about, you know, sort of portraying Indigenous people as sort of the victims of various pathologies. And then, you know, and this is something that many, many, many white Canadians continue to believe, there's an explicitly racist narrative about Indigenous poverty, which simply holds that, you know, it's the result of deficiencies of character and laziness and whatnot. So a look at the economic sort of aspects of the reserve system and the Indian Act system as they were implemented in the late 19th and earlier 20th centuries, well, into the mid-20th century, I guess, mostly we'll talk about, is, I think, sort of the key to actually understanding the historical roots of Indigenous poverty in Canada. So most of the examples that I'm going to use for this are going to come from one particular area, going to come from the area of Treaty 3 in northeastern Ontario. Treaty 3 in northwestern Ontario, near the border with Manitoba, because I happen to have sort of become familiar with some of that history in an academic context and have been able to find some, you know, some useful material around that. But these are examples that will sort of illustrate things that happened across the country. So one sort of extreme thing to start with, but I think sort of reveals a lot, is something that I think I referred to in passing the last time I was here, which is the peasant farming policy. So as is well known, one of the sort of the ideological rationales behind the establishment of the reserve system in the first place was to turn nomadic or semi-nomadic groups of Indigenous people into settled farmers. Because they wanted to clear them off of the land, but also because there was this idea that Indigenous people could be brought into settled agricultural civilization and assimilated. We'll talk more about assimilation later. But this was not implemented in any sort of straightforward way. And basically, because in the 1880s and 1890s, one of the leading sort of Indian affairs bureaucrats was a man named Hayter Reed, who believed very strongly in sort of the anthropological doctrines of the time, that there was this very strict hierarchy of stages of development that civilizations and societies had to pass through. He believed that, you know, Native people in Canada could not simply go from what he would have considered savagery in terms of hunting and gathering and nomadism to civilization and settled agriculture. They had to be led through all of these different stages. So what that meant was that for most of the 1890s, Indigenous people living on reserves were not allowed to use the latest agricultural technology. They were being forced to farm, but they were not allowed to use the farming techniques that were most efficient at the time. They had to use the same level of technology as medieval European peasants. And there was a lot of resistance to this policy. Many Indian agents on the ground gave up on implementing it. And it sort of, it demoralized a lot of indigenous farmers because it, you know, it wasn't economically viable at all. And many, you know, scholars who've looked at this this policy have argued that besides sort of Hayter Reed's particular ideology, the other aspect of why this was being done was because they wanted indigenous people to be able to farm enough that they wouldn't starve to death, but never enough that they would be competitive on the market for agricultural products with white settler farmers. And so that sort of ties into the more broadly sort of the nature of the economic impacts of the Indian Act system in its early decades and the reserve system in its early decades, which is that from the 1880s onward, a series of regulations are put in place under the Indian Act on every aspect of indigenous economic life, whether that's hunting, fishing, farming, and there were immense restrictions on what kind of technology indigenous people could use, how they could market their products, whether they were able to, you know, whether they were able to market them at all, or whether they were simply forced to stay at subsistence, whether they were, where and when they were able to hunt and fish. Most of the numbered treaties, incidentally, guarantee hunting and fishing rights in various ways. But this is something that the Indian Affairs Department started to quickly restrict, you know, from the 1880s onward. So you have the livelihoods of indigenous people being systematically undermined. And again, sort of the territory of Treaty 3 provides a really good example of this because before Treaty 3 was signed, Treaty 3 was signed in 1873, and in the earlier part of the 19th century, down to the 1860s, every, you know, Euro-Canadian observer who traveled to the territory, which is the area around the Lake of the Woods, the largest, you know, settlement there today is Kenora, said that, you know, the Anishinaabe people living at the Lake of the Woods were so prosperous that, you know, they didn't even, they didn't need to be involved in the fur trade, right? The HBC could never establish a real relationship with these people because there was abundant fish in that area, there was abundant game, you could harvest so-called wild rice very effectively every year, and they were also engaged in a little bit of farming. So when they signed Treaty 3, they drove a very hard bargain in the negotiations because they were economically independent. They couldn't be, you know, they couldn't be starved into an unacceptable deal like, you know, many nations in the Prairie West. And that continued for about a decade, the first decade of the reservation sort of era in that territory, because there were not actually white settlers entering into that part of what was about to become Northern Ontario at that time. But then from the later 1880s, people do start to do this. And so what you see across northern and western Canada as these new reserves are being established, and this is in some ways repeating processes that had taken place earlier, farther south and farther east, which we sort of talked about in that previous show. So what you see is, on the one hand, the increasing restriction of indigenous livelihoods, whether that's things like the peasant farming policy or the basic fact that people living on reservations were dependent on the Indian agent for access to seed and any kind of agricultural equipment and credit, and they were dependent on the Indian agent to sell their products, or the fact that they were often restricted from fishing or hunting for commercial purposes at all and were only allowed to do it for subsistence. And you see all of these policies sort of being turned to the benefit of white settlers who are moving into you know, this broad swath of northern and western Canada and starting to exploit the resources. So at the same time as these restrictions are being put in place, for example, again, in the territory of Treaty 3, you have large numbers of settlers who now start fishing and, you know, you start capitalist fishing, you know, and overfishing starts going on in the waters of the Lake of the Woods. And you have extensive logging, you have, you know, trapping and hunting by white, you know, by white settlers. You have mining starts to happen on indigenous land all across the country at this point. You have logging. You have all these sort of extractive processes. And indigenous people can't get jobs in these new industries that are being built on their land because of racism. And so within, you know, within a few decades, in, again, this area where the indigenous people, before they had, you know, signed this treaty with Canada, were economically independent and successful, within a few decades, between the fact that their farming had been hobbled by things like the peasant farming policy and the fact that They were now subject to provincial game laws, which was a violation of treaty rights, but they were. And there, you know, there have been court cases in the past few decades that have sort of confirmed the fact that, yes, provincial game laws were never supposed to be applied to indigenous people. But for most of the 20th century in all of the most provinces of Canada, the provincial governments and, you know, the agencies responsible for that area routinely violated treaty rights and, you know, sent people to jail for hunting on their own land. So between that and the restrictions on fishing and the fact that the ecological effects of certain kinds of development of hydroelectricity and dams and logging had actually changed the character of the lakes and the rivers and made it impossible, at least probably by the 1950s, but maybe even earlier than that, to harvest wild rice in this area. It was becoming basically impossible to live. And indigenous people at this point had no access to the sort of welfare, the very meager, you know, welfare and relief services that existed in mainstream Canadian society before the Second World War. And they couldn't really break into the wage economy, for example, except in sort of very insecure, very seasonal kind of ways, as, you know, very, very exploited labor at the lowest level of these extractive industries, or in the area around the Lake of the Woods, many Anishinaabe men worked as guides in the tourist industry. And many women sort of sold folk art, you know, to tourists and whatnot. But that wasn't really enough to live on. And many, you know, many people became sort of dependent as a last resort on their, you know, their backyard gardens. And there was an atmosphere of absolute, you know, desperation. And this is what, you know, in the 1960s, influenced by the civil rights movement, there was this sort of new wave of sort of white liberal Canadian attention to the conditions on reservations. And this is what they discovered, was people living in absolute misery because systematically, over the preceding decades, a network of state policies had been put in place to essentially constrain the ability of indigenous communities to support themselves as a means of giving over those resources and the ability to access those resources and to, you know, to accumulate wealth off of them over to the settler society, and especially, of course, the capitalist class of the settler society. So that sort of, in a nutshell, is, you know, sort of the economic kind of side of the Indian Act system in its sort of its earliest and sort of most repressive period of operation. One other thing that I'll say about that is there was also a very, very concerted effort to break up the communal aspect of the indigenous economy. Government officials in late 19th century Canada and the United States referred to indigenous societies as communist. And they compared them to the revolutionary movement that was developing out of the working class and industrial society in Europe. And they said that, you know, private property was the basis of civilization. And that for, you know, for native people to become civilized, the tribe or the commune had to be broken up, and native people had to come to see themselves as self-supporting, and, you know, the family as an independent economic unit out for itself in the world. And so there were systematic efforts both in Canada and the United States to divide up, especially in the 1880s and the 1890s, to divide up indigenous land into, you know, private property, which it had never been. That's totally alien, you know, to the traditions of any, you know, any indigenous society in North America. It wasn't pursued as rigorously in Canada as, you know, the property forms on reservations on reserves in Canada today are still pretty anomalous, but they're not exactly, you know, capitalist private property. But the idea was also, and this was, again, very successful in the U.S., was also to make the land more available to settlers, because land that's no longer the property of the community but is now the individual property, you know, of one indigenous person or one indigenous family, can now be sold to white settlers freely. And, you know, obviously people living in poverty are more likely than not to, you know, to sell what they can, you know, for short-term benefit if they've been sort of, you know, encouraged to think in that way, in that sort of that individualist kind of way. So there was a concerted effort to do that. And that is still going on, right? There's extensive, you know...